I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Good evening to those online and those in the room, and welcome to Shakespeare & Company in Paris for this very special event on the occasion of Ulysses' 100th birthday, because it was on the 2nd of February 1922 that Ulysses was published and was displayed in the window of Sylvia Beach's bookshop of the same name. And here we are now, 100 years on, with, in fact, one of those first 1,000 Ulysseses, now owned by the current custodians of the Shakespeare and Company name. And I'm very glad to be joined this evening by Tom McCarthy and Susan Phillips. Susan Phillips is an artist whose work deals with spatial properties of sound and the relationship between sound and architecture. She lives and works in Berlin and won the Turner Prize in 2010. Tom McCarthy also lives and works in Berlin and is the author of novels including Sea, Saturn Island, and most recently The Making of Incarnation, published last year. He also writes occasionally for the LRB, including a piece about Ulysses in 2014. More about that in a moment. This event is the first in a series of events the LRB will be running throughout 2022 and maybe into the first weeks of 2023, marking some of the many significant centenaries of this year zero for literary modernism. We've also about to publish a small book of pieces about some of those key moments with an introduction by Tom. Today is also the day that Shakespeare and Company's really amazing Ulysses podcast project launches, a complete reading of Ulysses, which will be published as podcast episodes between now and Bloomsday. It began at, I think, midnight last night with Will Self reading the first 20 or so pages of Telemachus. Final thing to say is that this isn't a conversation about Ulysses in really the purest sense. It's not a close reading. It's not a sort of intense discussion of experts. The title we've given it is In the Wake of Ulysses, which is also the title of Tom's LRB piece. And it's really about a conversation with two practitioners talking about working in that wake, how Ulysses has fed into and inflected their work. And so for really close textual discussion of particular scenes or what have you, I recommend the Shakespeare and Company podcast instead. So to kick off, Tom, I thought perhaps you could read the opening paragraph of your LRB essay.
Okay, well, first of all, it's an honour to be here on this day. Thank you for Sylvia and everyone for inviting us. Okay, how do you write after Ulysses? That's the question. Whenever I sit down to write a novel, Anthony Burgess claimed, it is with a sense of despair because I know I'll never match that book. It isn't just that Joyce writes better than anyone else, although he does. Beyond that, it's the sense that Ulysses' publication entails a kind of rapture for literature, an event in equal parts ecstatic and catastrophic, perhaps even apocalyptic. A certain naive realism is no longer possible after it, but hasn't every alternative, every avant-garde manoeuvre imaginable also been anticipated and exhausted by it too? As though that weren't enough, Joyce returns to the scene of his own crime, arriving not incognito in the manner of his shady non-character Macintosh, but brazenly assuming the role of principal mourner, just as Ulysses was initially conceived as an extra chapter to Dubliners, Finnegan's Wake gestated as a 19th episode of Ulysses. We should not only consider all three works as part of a continuum whose critical moment, and I use this term in the dramatic sense, the sense of crisis, remains Ulysses, but also view Ulysses itself as a work whose own wake, and that perhaps of the novel, tout court, is already at work in it. What new patterning, what ploughing of the sea, could a writer envisage that would pattern independent of the ripple field already sent out by Joyce's churning up the sum of its mutating patterns? Derrida hits the nail on the head when he complains of Joyce's relentless hypermnesia that, as he puts it, a priori indebts you, inscribes you in advance in the book you are reading. The future, he affirms, is reserved in it.
That's the problem. And I suppose the first question to ask, the first question, Tom, to ask in light of that question is, how do you write after Ulysses?
I like that metaphor of endless debt. I mean, you know, the question isn't, I mean, Joyce is obsessed with money in all his work, and literature itself is almost like a legacy to be inherited or to be squandered or to be, or an indebtedness. And this plays out very explicitly in Ulysses, but also even more in Finnegan's Wake. But I think, you know, in the end, he almost suggests that by acknowledging this endless debt, you also acquire an endless credit. It makes everything possible. There's a wonderful scene in Ulysses where Stephen, the wannabe poet, is arguing with the successful poet A.E., who's come out of some trite Neoplatonic nonsense in the National Library. And Stephen knows he could take him down, but he owes him money. And then he goes, actually, but maybe it was another I that owes him, because as Aristotle says, all the molecules change. So maybe it wasn't me that borrowed the money. And then in the end, he says, no, I do. I am indebted. He goes, A-E, I owe you, which is it's the five letters. It's the vowels, right? It's his, that's his reserve and storehouse, the alphabet. You know, language becomes this kind of, through acknowledging an indebtedness, he kind of manages to find a kind of a possibility for some future something. And I think that's I relate to that as a way of, you know, you're in Ulysses's wake, and that makes you impossibly indebted, but also infinitely possible. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. And was reading Ulysses for the first time, reading Joyce for the first time, an ecstatic, catastrophic, apocalyptic moment in your life?
The first time I read it completely blind, like without any notes. And I thought it was a very sad book about unhappy marriages and unfulfilled possibilities. And then I read it almost immediately again with notes, with the Blamires book. This is back in the late 80s. Now you have the internet. And I thought it was a rapturous, ecstatic book. And then by the third time I read it, I realized I hadn't really been wrong the first time. It is, I mean, it's melancholic in the Freudian sense. It's like this unpleasurable, infectious, toxic, kind of contagious thing that is, and in the medieval sense of like Melachole, it's full of black bile. It's the most base materialist book, splattering this blackness everywhere, which again is kind of, before we went on air, we were talking about the link between gunpowder and ink that keeps coming up in Ulysses. And I think that's quite an important, I mean, it begins, you know, he wakes, it begins in a gun, in a huge tower, one of whose floors was for storing gunpowder. It's like a massive explosion. And in fact, the story behind it is that Joyce's flatmate fired a gun over his head while he had a gun inside a gun. And then he goes to Trieste to write it, which Marinetti called La Nostra Bella Polveraria, you know, our great gunpowder magazine. There's something, yes, rapturous and ecstatic and explosive about it.
Susan, would you describe your first encounter with Joyce as ecstatic or?
Well, I find it's, well, it was The Dead that I really had a big impact on me when I first read The Dubliners. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not just because of its emotional and impact, but also that I discovered that Joyce is really passionate about music and song in particular, and especially that song, the song The Lass of Aughrim. So that's what got me hooked on Joyce.
Well, that leads neatly into something that we're going to be doing throughout the event this evening, which is interspersing conversation with excerpts from Susan's works that have been inspired by Joyce. So do you want to talk a little bit more about the Dead? And then we'll play a clip from it.
Yeah. Well, The Dead, as I said, Joyce loved to sing. And I came across this quote by Joyce. Je n'aime pas la musique, j'aime le chant. I don't like music, I like singing. And, you know, and singing is in all of his writings. And I suppose the song from The Dead is the most famous song of all his writings. And Joyce loved the song. Joyce would sing it endlessly. They would used to laugh at him how often he would sing this Lass of Aughrim at home. And The Lass of Aughrim, the song, is a broken token song. There's a whole tradition of these broken token songs. And a broken token song is when a broken token is when you exchange a token with your lover, or maybe who's gone off to war for 7 years and comes back and you don't recognize him and they can prove who you are. Or, you know, they sleep together and you can prove that you did that. So in this case of The Lass of Aughrim, she comes with the token and a baby in her arms, but none will let her in. She's left in the cold with her baby, and it's very sad, the song. And in fact, Joyce says of that song, the tears come into my eyes and my voice trembles with emotion when I sing that lovely air. So, you know, but it was only when I saw the movie by John Huston, his really faithful adaptation of The Dead, that I actually learned the songs. I didn't know the tune before. I just read it in The Dead. And so that's the version that I know. And so what I've done is I've recorded me singing The Lass of Aughrim over and over, but I'm singing it in a more of a kind of unself-conscious way, more retrospectively, to create a sense of solitude. And also I've left these pauses in between where you also hear the ambient sounds of the room, distant hum of traffic, my own breath. So you get a sense of my presence. And then I've taken... So I sing it over and over a period of 20 minutes, and then I've taken that recording and transposed it onto 35mm film and have that projected in the darkened gallery space in Dublin, in the Irish Museum of Modern Art in Dublin. And but I've also shown it in cinemas as well. But so... So this voice, which is transposed onto this black film stock, there's no imagery, but over time the film stock begins to deteriorate, and you see these blemishes, these scratches on the film, and you know, and the film is darkly illuminated because it's black, but there's still a presence of this, like, I mean, it creates a kind of almost spectral presence with the voice. And I'm singing in the first person, the song's in the first person, so it's almost like I'm taking on this character of The Lass of Aughrim. But then, I was really inspired by the film as well, John Huston's adaptation, because the last scene, you know, the pivotal moment in the story is when they're leaving the party on the Feast of the Epiphany, and and Gabriel's waiting at the foot of the stairs, and Greta but stops, and she becomes enraptured by the sound of someone singing, and it's the song The Lass of Aughrim. And Gabriel can't hear it, but she can hear it faintly, and he's been encouraged to sing it all night, but he refuses because his voice is hoarse and he doesn't remember all the words. But it just brings her back to this time where she knew Michael Fury, who dies for her love, and it just makes her, and so her expression that Gabriel's captivated by her expression and how, but she's in another place. She's with Michael Fury, like when she was when they were young, you know. And so then he has this epiphany later that he could never love like Michael Fury could, how Michael Fury loved her. So that is the pivotal moment in the whole story, where she hears this song. So I've recorded it and on this black film stock. And so the final moment of the film is when he's looking out into the night sky, and the snow is falling faintly over the bog. And you mean it's just Shannon's waves. And over the headstones and all the living and the dead, you know, the famous scene at the end. But then the camera pans up to, and this is the notes from Tony Houston from the movie, camera pans up to the night sky until flakes of snow fall directly into the lens, fade out, the end. Mm-hmm. So my work, The Dead, is almost like an extension of that last scene in the film, you know, where the camera pans up into the night sky.
Tom, I feel like there's a sort of interesting distinction to be drawn between how you and Susan respond to Joyce, and potentially Ulysses as well, which is that Susan engages very much both kind of specifically and sensorially, whereas, at the risk of over-sybilizing this, you seem concerned with systems. And it seems to me that, I mean, this is obviously very much a feature of your fiction, particularly your most recent novel, seeing systems in everything. And the system behind what you're seeing, but particularly in your LRB piece, Ulysses to you is I made a list: money and accountancy, human waste on an industrial scale, formal language, technology and radio, the history of literature itself. How does something, you know, seeing a work as a whole like that, feed then into how you use it?
Well, yes. I mean, Ulysses is about systems. Joyce was a big fan of Sterne, and I think he conceives his own work very like Sterne conceives Tristram Shandy, which is he calls it like an adventitious set of mechanisms all interlinked one within the other, such that even in digressing it is progressive, because one lever here causes a part in the other, you know, everything is on an ellipse that feeds back through every other part and they're all conjoined. And this is true, but I wouldn't want you to think that I see it as some kind of Hegelian abstract system. I mean, Joyce is an absolute materialist. And not just a materialist in the sense that he conceives of the work of the structure of a novel mechanically, although he does, but he's a base materialist. He's really into splattery, sloppy, messy. I mean, the system he's most fascinated by is the sewage system. Keeps coming back in Ulysses, the cloacal system of the British Empire. But the whole of culture he sees as a sewage system. I mean, seriously, as everything is recircling, everything is being digested, excreted, and then re-ingested, even though it's poisonous, it's being re-ingested. And I mean, this is what Stephen's doing walking on the beach. He's literally treading over bloated corpses of dog carcasses and sewage and broken objects, and each of these objects carries a cultural history with it. So it's a completely kind of Bataillon, like base material reading of history. And I think this is how he conceives language, you know, poetry as well. That, as Stephen says, these heavy tides are language, you know, heavy of the past. But even when, you know, his models for generating writing in Ulysses, his metaphors for that are not airy and refined. It's Stephen urinating. It's him smearing snot on a rock. It's Molly Bloom vomiting, I mean, regurgitating seed cake into Leopold's mouth. It's an incredibly abject but beautiful kind of moment of transmission. I mean, it's seed cake, it's dissemination, right? It's material transmission. So yeah, it is completely sensuous. When Bloom is in the printing press in the Aeolus chapter, the presses are shunting, they're going salt, salt, and he says everything speaks. I mean, it's like what Susan was saying about her breath and the haptic sensuousness of making music. It's not an abstract spiritual thing. And I love the way Susan uses, I think it's very similar to the way it's exactly the logic of Joyce. Everything is broken down and fragmented and recycled and repurposed and taken to another part of the system where it kind of like a virus reinfects that new kind of, causes a new mutation.
I can't help but be struck by the contrast between your account of Ulysses and the spectacle that greeted us as we arrived at Shakespeare and Company today, with people dressed as characters, as Joyce himself, and the kind of Bloomsday pageantry, which is obviously particularly a feature of how we think about Ulysses in a centenary year like this. I wonder how something so visceral can also become something kitsch, and how. And whether it takes, I mean, this might be becoming pretentious, but whether it takes artists to recover that viscerality.
To recover it from the recuperation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, exactly. I
mean, bringing another ghost of these parts of Paris, Debord, into play. Sure, yes. I mean, there's a tendency to... I think one danger of how not to write after Ulysses, and I think writing, creative writing programs have a lot to answer for here. There's a mistake to kind of think that if something looks a bit Joycean or Burkettian, then it must be really cool. And I think there's a tendency in recent years of seeing what are ultimately rather sentimental humanist novels that look a bit Joycean and demand to be kind of revered. You know, content becomes style. And I think that's the danger. When something is just reduced to style, it becomes kitsch. And I think, you know, like Ulysses demands to be read carefully. It makes a huge demand, if, you know, to read it very carefully again and again. And if you actually do that, what opens up is not a style or an attitude or a particular kind of ideology or whatever. It's a set of very Proteus-like, hard to grasp and endlessly changing possibilities that need to be interpreted always imperfectly, and that interpretation is can be a work of art, but it's not about one other point would be that I think Joyce, you know, in his fascination with Vico and the circularity of history, he kind of almost inaugurates a new type of cultural time where culture isn't moving in a progressive line, even from one avant-garde to the next. Right. So after John Cage has done 4 minutes, 33 seconds of silence, the challenge is not to do 4 minutes and 34 seconds or even 5 minutes or 10 minutes. It's to really rigorously attend to what provocation is being made there and work out how to respond to it, which will not be imitation.
When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment your work stress disappears as you kayak through the canyons. Or the moment you discover the life-changing effects of prickly pear chocolate. But nothing beats the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the very first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.
So, you've got an idea for a business. The store of your dreams. There's just one thing to figure out. Everything. That's why Shopify's all-in-one commerce platform makes it easy to sell online, in person, and everywhere else. Sell on social media, source products with an app to get that first sale feeling. It's the only solution that gives you everything you need to sell everywhere you want. So when you're ready to bring your idea to life, power it up with Shopify.
Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/listen.
Susan, in terms of, I mean, so in your work, you've been inspired by and worked with Joyce material 6 times, is that right?
That's right. Yeah. 6 times. Yeah.
It began with the dead and something you've highlighted specifically about these projects is often they're quite concerned with darkness and Joyce. And that is interesting to me because it seems to me this quite specific and sensory engagement with the material. Do you want to talk a bit about how darkness and Joyce have found their way into so many of your projects?
Yeah, it's funny because I hadn't really made the connection until now. You know, I thought, hang on, appear to me, I see a darkness. They all take place in the dark. And I suppose when you can't see, you know, you switch from the visual to the oral, where you're having to use your ears to just navigate the space and work out the space with the acoustics and so I mean, I thought that was interesting as well in Ulysses, when Stephen Dedalus was on the beach and he closes his eyes, and you know, so in a similar way I'm as a visual artist working with sound, that's what I'm doing. You know, I'm asking people to listen, and so in the darkness, it becomes, you know, this spectral voice in the darkness, especially my earlier works where I was using my voice a lot, the inspiration was coming from Joyce's love of song, you know. But I was also became fascinated by, and also Joyce is his passion for cinema. You know, as you know, he opened the first cinema in Dublin and in the Volta, and he convinced these two brothers, Italian brothers, to open it and to finance it, and so. He kitted out, employed staff, made the program. So he was the cinematographer. He was the projectionist, you know. And I thought I came across this really great quote as well from Joyce. Whenever I'm obliged to close my eyes, I see a cinematograph going round and around, and it brings back all these memories that I thought I'd long forgotten. Mm-hmm. So he cinema, and in fact, even. What considered making Ulysses into a film, maybe by Eisenstein or mm-hmm. Walter Ruttmann, but in the end it was Joseph Strict who did a great thing. But anyway, sorry, I'm digressing. But cinema needs the dark as well. But I became really fascinated by Joyce's daughter Lucia, mm-hmm. and Lucia Joyce who danced here in Paris with Isadora Duncan and she danced while Joyce was writing about this female character with wildwood eyes and primrose hair, and he used to call Lucia his wonder wild, and so she used to dance barefoot and she was their dance troupe were really connected to nature, and they used to call their performances, the Savage Vines, or the Enchanted Garden, or the Green Panther, you know. Yeah. So she was a really, very passionate dancer. But then sadly she became through mental illness, she fell into darkness and obscurity, and she was sequestered to different institutions, and finally it. Spent out the remainder of her life in Northampton, you know, where she died. So it's a very sad story for Lucia Joyce. So what I did was make a work that was installed in Tate Modern in the Tanks, which is very dark, and the work was dedicated I See a Darkness. Yeah. And the work was dedicated to two Lucias, Santa Lucia, the patron saint of blindness and light, and to Lucia Joyce. And and so there was three parts to the work, but I really worked with the acoustics of this, the very particular acoustics of this circular space, you know, and I created a whispering gallery with mm-hmm. the first part, which is this duet, which almost takes on her character, the words of Will Oldham's I See a Darkness, mm-hmm. which is where I got the title from. And so that plays out in the space, but I made it into a whispering gallery, so it seems like the sound, the voice is completely disembodied, like it's coming from nowhere. And yeah, so
let's,
that
you know, should we say a clip of it?
Yeah, let's go watch a clip of it. That's what you told me. What's inside of me? Did you ever notice the kind of thoughts I've got? Well, you know I have a love, a love for everyone I know. And you know I have a drive to live, I won't let go. Dreadful imposition comes blocking in my mind. And then I see a darkness, and then I see a darkness, and then I see a darkness, and then I see a darkness. Did you know how much I there's a hope that somehow you
obviously a place where some of these things coincide, coalesce, specifically in Ulysses, is in the Sirens section. And so, Tom, I wonder if you could read a bit from Sirens.
Sure. Simon Dedalus is singing Martha, singing Ma Paris from the opera by Flotow, Martha. And Joyce writes of his voice, Its sword, a bird, it held its flight, a swift pure cry, saw silver orb it leaped serene, speeding sustained to come, don't spin it out to long, long breath, he breathed long life, soaring high, high resplendent, a flame, crowned, high in the effulgent, symbolistic, high of the ethereal bosom, high of the high, vast irradiation everywhere, all soaring, all around, about the all, the endlessnessnessness.
So that specific passage from Sirens was then the basis of another work of yours.
That's right. It was a work called Appear to Me, Ma Paris, which I made for a monastery in northern Spain called Silos. And Lynn Cook from Reni Sofia commissioned it, and we went out there together to have a look. And we passed through this vulture sanctuary on the way, and we stopped and we watched the vultures reeling around in the sky, and it was incredible to see. And then we got to the monastery, and in the cloisters there were these pillars with all these amazing carvings of winged animals, you know, griffins and harpies, you know, which are a hybrid of a female and a bird, and so a bit like sirens. And so, and then there were the monks were also singing at that time we arrived, and they were doing the Vespers. And so all these things were going on in my head when I started to think about what I might do there. And I was brought to this darkened cellar and said this could be a place that I could work with. So, and that's what brought me to the passage that Tom just read out from the Sirens. And I read a long time ago that when Joyce wrote that, he had in his mind that it was to the tune of Salve Regina. So I thought, That was the work then. It was me singing this passage, It's Sword a Bird, but to the tune of Salve Regina. And then it had this connection with the birds and fly and the birds that I saw in the cloisters. And then it had that emanate from the darkness. And yeah, so I suppose in the context of monastery, it has other connotations of, you know, that are an apparition or, you know, but yeah, so that was what it was.
And with Joyce and ideas as they come to you, is it usually that way round, that you see a space and then it kind of triggers a memory of a text, or does it sometimes the other way round? Is it sometimes that...
It's mostly, I'd say 90% it starts with I have to go there and get the inspiration from the place, and yeah.
And then that kind of, you have a kind of Rolodex of cultural memories.
Yeah, well, things come to my mind, you know, like, you know, I used to sing Salve Regina, you know, when I was in the choir as a child, so I knew the song, and then I was really interested in, and of course Joyce, he went to Jesuit school, and he was very familiar with all those Gregorian chants as well. So, yeah. But yeah, it usually begins with the place, you know, what the atmosphere or the you know, the history, or just anything really that kind of.
Susan's going to sing Appear to Me live in a bit, but before we get to that, Tom, I want to ask you, I mean, the thing that I find fascinating about this particular work of Susan's is that it takes two component parts of Joyce's text and actually creates something new out of them. You can either see it as realizing something that's implied, or you can see it as taking
a mutation.
Exactly, yeah. A mutation of the polyphony.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering whether, I mean, something that people always often say about Ulysses is that you sort of create it as you read it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if that is similar to how you feel yourself kind of writing sentences with Joyce's example in mind.
Yeah, I mean, I think Joyce thought that his would be the last work. It would be the end of the novel. And I think he was not just wrong. He was like exactly wrong. It's almost like the first novel, or even beyond that. It's the source code. It's the possibility of the novel become legible, which is miraculous. So yeah, it's always there, but it's not something, again, it's not something to be kind of flipped over or realized, or it's not like some secret recipe, and it's certainly not something to be imitated. It's more just that you suddenly become aware of a set of a possibility. I mean, that's when you start writing. And Joyce is very often, he's like McCavity. he might not be there, but he's always there. Do you know what I mean?
Have you ever found yourself, I mean, probably your answer to this question means you haven't, but specifically feeling like you're completing something, a trick or an experiment or a kind of Joycean gambit in what you're doing yourself?
I definitely take cues. I mean, the first novel I published, Remainder, is very much about reenactment and repetition. And you know, I didn't think consciously, oh, I'm going to write a novel about reenactment because that's the new model that Joyce, via Vico, through Yeats, through Beckett, gives us. I mean, it was never that deliberate, but I'm sure having been exposed to that stuff was very much there. But I was also just watching, like, football replays on TV and the slow repetition of the goal, and then seeing how, remembering how in the playground you do it another 20 times the next day, and this space of repetition. And so it's not really answering the question, so it's
no, but I feel like it comes back to systems. I feel like there are there are systems contained within Joyce that are of deep kind of intellectual and inspirational interest to you. And then there are systems in the wider world that you want to try and capture.
But they're not closed systems. I mean, Joyce is about the breakdown of system. Yeah. I mean, he makes, to take accountancy, you know, he does meticulous accounting of everything in Ulysses. But Leopold Bloom gets the final double entry account wrong at the end of the book. So wrong that one editor actually went and corrected it.
Right.
Which is kind of like making Hamlet kill Claudius in scene 3 of Act 1 to correct Hamlet. I mean, the whole point is, again, and we come back to Tristram Shandy, there is a system, but it's broken. And thank God, because that breach is that rupture is the possibility of something else happening. Mm. Otherwise, it would be the end of the novel and the end of history and a very totalitarian world of the imagination.
I wonder if I could also just ask you about sort of sirens specifically, and also something that you told me when we were thinking about this event, which is that radio is where is where yours and Susan's work meets.
Yeah, we've both done projects, radio projects, that were enormously indebted to Joyce, maybe more the Joyce of Finnegan's Wake, where radio really becomes a big presence. He writes about Marconi masts beaming timeless secrets to Sisting Nova Scotia's listing sister wands. Like, radio and incest is basically that where my novel C takes off. And I know Susan's done some wonderful projects of transmitting radio around the islands of Scandinavia that were very consciously, like, indebted to that, right? As well.
Yeah, the Marconi when sounds are generated never die. I mean, that was something that really inspired me when I first came across that, you know. But Marconi believed that the pioneer of radio, when sounds are generated, they never die, that they're endlessly out there in the universe, you know. And so this conversation tonight will always be there, however faintly, you know. So that I found that very,
It will also literally always be there on YouTube.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But the critic Jane Lutie, her take on Finnegan's Wake, she's edited a book called Broadcasting Modernism. But her take on Finnegan's Wake is that it's basically a radio set. The head of the dream is like a radio set, and we're just going through the channels and getting all this interference. I think that's a very good way of understanding it. But I think that's already kind of implicit in Ulysses, the way music works. As it's always about... He plays on the word coffin, right? When you lift up the lid of a piano, he always calls it the coffin of the piano. And it's very deliberate. Mm. It's ghosts. And they're material ghosts. You know, the voice has a timbre. It's not abstract. It's a physical thing riding on the air like a stench or a ghoul or something. And and it's being fragmented and passed around. And I think, yeah, in the Sirens, you really see that.
Yeah.
The way he does that.
Yeah, I suppose what I'm really interested in is the idea that because of, I mean, obviously Sirens opens with this famously esoteric passage that has been variously understood as kind of the musicians of the chapter warming up, the overture of the chapter, kind of providing the material that's then used. But what seems interesting to me about this kind of version of language is that to some extent it makes more sense to interact with it in a way that isn't necessarily reading. It sort of floats. And I wonder whether there's anything in the way that sort of texts exist in your inspirations that feel like that, whether they're not so much things you read as things that kind of float into your consciousness when you're in a space.
Well, sure, songs do.
Yeah,
like the way that the Salve Regina came to my mind when I was in the monastery, but also been under the bridge in Munster, the barcarolle from the Tales of Hoffmann, it came to my mind because of the words far away, you know, people, like two people singing across water to one another. These words came to just kind of drifted in from a long time ago, and I'm not knowing that it was actually from this German composer, this barcarolle. I didn't know who'd written it then, but it's from The Lost Reflection, The Tales of Hoffmann, and so there was all these crazy coincidences, like the fact that I was staring across the water at people staring back at me as if looking into my own reflection, and so that's where the tales of the lost reflection came.
Mm-hmm.
But first of all, it was just these words, mm-hmm. Far away, you know, looking across the water at people looking back at me. So yeah, sometimes it just drifts in like that.
Mm. Would you like to sing? Appear to me.
Okay, I'll try. I'll try. Yeah. So, it's sort of bird, it held its flight, as with pure cry, so silver orbit leaps serene. Speeding sustained, to come don't spin it out too long. Breathe he breathe long life, soaring high, high resplendent aflame. Crowned high in the effulgence, symbolistic, high of the ethereal bosom, high of the vast iridation everywhere. Oh, soaring all around about the all,
I certainly won't be able to read that passage in Sirens without hearing that now. I'm going to just get my phone out because it's on here that I'm being sent questions from the online audience. And so I'm just going to take a look at these. Revac asks, sound, image, memory, darkness. I wonder if the sound opens up endless possibility, tying in with a possible open system, whether there is a kind of inbuilt openness through sound.
Well, okay. Again, we need to read it carefully, right? And while Simon is singing, Bloom thinks there's a very specific set of associations run through at that point. And Bloom has this reflection about music. He goes, "What? Hang on, before that, Martha, the opera that he's singing from is about someone who pretends to be someone else." Mm-hmm. Bloom thinks about Martha, his pen friend, who isn't called Martha. She's pretending to be someone else. He's pretending to be someone else. He also remembers the first time he meets Molly over a musical evening where they're playing musical chairs, which again is this kind of almost like an algorithmic choreography for people to change places and substitute each other. And then it cuts away to Boylan, because Martha's also about infidelity, and it cuts away to Boylan, who's arriving to have sex with Bloom's wife, Molly. So all these different times and places are carried in on the music. Again, it's like this elaborate, constellated kind of set of movable parts that are all linked together around the song. The song is what makes that linking mm-hmm. possible. And then Bloom has this reflection. It's quite interesting. He has this vision of almost a platonic vision of a mathematical universe, which song manages. He says, "Numbers it is, all music when you come to think. Two multiplied by two divided by half is twice one. Vibrations, chords those are. One plus two plus six is seven. Symmetry under a cemetery," the coffin again, "under a cemetery wall." Then he thinks about guts. Then he says, but suppose you said, "Martha, 7 times 9 minus X is 35,000, fall quite flat. It's all on account of the sound it is." I mean, he's not articulate enough to express it, but he's kind of, but Stephen does a couple of chapters later, while another piece of music is being played, again, mechanically on a gramophone, or maybe it's a pianola with a machine. And he suddenly has this vision of ellipses and a kind of platonic structure of the universe. And he starts talking about commercial travelers, Greek heroes, Shakespeare gods, all wandering around time and space, which is obviously exactly what Ulysses is. And again, it's the music. It's the music that manages this, the music underwrites this possibility of all this stuff happening, of all this structuration. and then Stephen, although he is articulate enough, is also massively drunk, so he can't articulate it either. So it all collapses back into sounds and gastric burps and things. Then he goes outside to piss or something.
Lawrence Rainey in the LRB, he talks about something very similar to that sense of music. But almost in the way of it overwhelming the ability of the book to actually tell its own story. I wonder if that's if there is a sense sometimes of that force kind of overwhelming itself, or do you think it's always kept in check?
No, I think it is overwhelming, and that's good. Mean, this is in Ulysses language. I really dislike it when people talk about, like, teachers and critics talk about interior monologue to describe the unassigned first person narrative, because I don't think it is interior monologue. It's exterior, it's embodied, encorpsed consciousness. Language is just another organ in Ulysses. And Ulysses is a genuinely obscene book in which organs are whipped out and flashed left, right and centre. And language is flashed left, right and centre. I mean, you see letters, H-E-L-Y-S, advertising Healy stationers walking down the street, eating bread. I mean, the letters, the book's letters are eating and crapping. And music is one of the main kind of examples of it. It keeps rupturing the membrane, the skin of the book, and getting in the way excessively. And that's the nature of the book. And that's the nature of, you know, the world. And this is a good thing. It should not be kept in check.
it was described as a gigantic symphony. Someone wrote that.
A couple of questions about darkness and light. Mm-hmm. So Bernard asks, isn't the darkness of the book turned into light by the kindness of Bloom? Which obviously, I mean, it's more that darkness has become connected with your sense of Joyce, but it is an interesting idea that Ulysses is a novel in which darkness turns into light.
Yeah, well, it's all in the daytime, mostly Ulysses. Yeah. It's more Finnegan's Wake that's the darkness. Mm-hmm. And except for that bit when he's on the beach, you know, and he closes his eyes for me, and what does he say? He says, shut your eyes and see. Mm-hmm. And for me, you know, that is really, as I said before, it's like something that I can really relate to. And, you know, the way he describes walking with the stick, like as if blind. And, you know, of course, Joyce connects to Joyce's darkness, his own deteriorating eyesight. But yeah, I suppose for me, my Joyce, the inspiration, were mainly in the darkness, to be experienced in the darkness. But Ulysses was more a book that was in the day. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, do you buy that redemptive kind
no,
of idea?
There's no redemption. There's, or like Kafka says, there's redemption, but not for us. Mm. I mean... It is a sad book because there's this big epic Homeric, you know, almost religious outside, which remains outside. And the only way it connects with stuff in the book is as a negative. So it's, you know, Bloom is not Odysseus. Molly is not Penelope. A piece of dental floss is not an A.E. Olin harp string. And some spilled beer on a bar counter is not the foam on a siren's rock. Everything is affected as a kind of negative. And even this kind of, you know, some early, especially Christian critics or champions even of Ulysses, tried to present it as a great redemptive reconciliation at the end. And it's not, you know, they haven't had sex for 10 years. They've got their dead kid hovering the bed between them, and they sleep end to end. Nothing happens. Nothing is said. She doesn't say yes. Yes is what she doesn't say. Mm. She doesn't say anything. But an alignment has come into place, an alignment of stars and associations and symbols and possibilities. You know, history for Stephen is all the events that didn't happen. But through retroactive arrangement, you can almost astronomically, you can see a constellated coming together of a plane of consciousness, of dead stars, and that's a miracle. But you can't realize it as in the here and now. Mm-hmm. You can only discern it retrospectively, and that's what the work of art's there for, perhaps.
I want to give our very small in the room audience an opportunity to ask a question, but while they're weighing up whether or not to put their hands, I thought I'd ask you, Susan, do you expect Joyce to continue to feed into projects?
I do, especially after the conversations I've been having with Tom. I mean, he's seen things in my work that connect to Joyce that I didn't see.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's definitely, it's been a while. Since last one, 2010, and to be invited here today in this discussion, it's given me a lot of, food for thought.
Do you think the reason that it has been a while is because it's specifically your work with your voice that this kind of body of influence connects with?
Yeah, I suppose I've been thinking... I've been working more, I've continued to work with my voice, but in a more abstract way. But Tom and I were discussing how, you know, this fragmented, the way I fragment the compositions and break them down and just focus on each individual tone. And it's more about the physicality of producing the sounds. He could see Joyce in that, but I had never made that connection, you know, but mm-hmm. maybe it was there. It was unconscious, mm-hmm. but... So I think that's definitely something I would like to explore, you know.
Mm.
But one of the things that we didn't talk about was our love of the, you know, in Finnegan's Wake, Anne Olivia Plurabelle chapter and Joyce's voice. You know, Joyce brings that to life when he recites it. I mean, it was written to be spoken, you know. And that inspired a composer to put it to music, and then that inspired me to make a work about that. So Joyce's voice is very, and not only his voice, but how he writes, you know, it's the how it flows and the phonetically and the onomatopoeia, everything is very musical. Mm. So inspiring. yeah.
any questions from the room? Was there a hand up? Yeah.
Well, banal question, maybe. Time and Joyce. I've just been to an exhibition across the way on Proust and his life, and I wonder they must have lived in the same city. Is there any interaction between them? That's the historical question. And is there any interrelationship between their senses of time?
So I think they meet once, very briefly, just before Ulysses is published.
Sorry, just to step in, Tom, in case that wasn't picked up by the microphones. The question's about Proust and Joyce.
I think they actually met once, very briefly, before Ulysses was published. But by the time Joyce writes Finnegan's Wake, he's read Proust. And Proust appears in Finnegan's Wake. He talks about the Marceline, last time we had our little recherche with, he was all dipping Madeleines in something. And he ties him in with Weinstein, Einstein, and Bichson, Bergson. So yeah, Proust was important to him. But I think, I mean, Joyce has, I think the main models of time in Joyce are, by Finnegan's Wake, it's Viconian. The idea of history is a bit like for Marx or Nietzsche, it's this repetition cycle. But it's not exactly repetition. A ricorso is like a conscious repetition. You go over it's like a spring. You go over the same ground, but you're aware of it. So it has a historiographical sense. And that's already gestating in Ulysses with all their endless circulations, and you get phrases like history repeating itself with a difference when he gives... He remembers giving Parnell a hat back, and then the way he corrected the hat on one of the mourners at Paddy Dickens' funeral. But I think the main temporal model in Ulysses is this more Walter Benjamin type one of simultaneity, constellation, constellating all this stuff together. A plane of simultaneity emerges that can only be construed retrospectively. So Molly brings absolutely everything into alignment, lying in bed. But the stars have already faded, Stephen's already gone. It's too late, you know. The only good thing to come out of that day is Ulysses, basically.
I'm grateful for that question because it ties in nicely with a reminder that this is the first event in a series of events inspired by such things that happened in 1922 as the death of Proust. Also the famous debate between Bergson and Einstein, which we have a piece about in the book introduced by Tom. I think we'll stop there. I'd just like to thank Adam, Sylvia and David from Shakespeare and Company for hosting us tonight, and Tom and Susan for being so interesting and insightful and inspiring. Thanks for joining us, and we'll be back on the 23rd of February for an event about the Dark Night of the Soul, or rather the Dark Night of sort of 3 weeks of Dark Nights of
Hurricanes.
The Soul for Rilke. Hurricanes. That produced, for Rilke, that produced the Duino Elegies and the Sonnets to Orpheus. So I hope you'll join us for that. But for the time being, good night.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.